Welcome back to Plot Pit, the show where we forge fiction from fact and folklore. William Atkinson here in studio with local authors, plural, John LeMay.
Hey, Will.
And Beverly Coots. Welcome back, Beverly.
Hello. It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Arrow, you are one of our early guests and also one of our more popular episodes with the leprechauns that we did and the frost giants.
Oh, that was fun.
Actually, yeah. So when we did our Alaska episode, that's actually one of our top listens.
Hmm. Cool.
So what do we have today, John?
I brought with us fossils and mythology.
Fossils.
Yeah.
And mythology. Let's begin the descent. John, introduce us to fossils and mythology.
So one of my favorite books I've read recently, it's not a new book, I think it came out around 2000. It's called Fossil Legends of the First Americans by Adrian Mayer. Mayer is in like a town mayor. Really great book. So if you love mythology or paleontology, or especially if you love both, I mean, that's the book for you. Because it's all about how the Native American peoples would dig up mastodon bones or dinosaur bones, and they would associate them with their legends, or they would make up legends that, oh, this bone must have belonged to the feared giant Yetso or whoever. And just a really cool book. But there was a couple stories or myths in it that caught my imagination's eye that I thought I'd bring to us today that we'd work with. So before we delve in, we've got to talk just a little bit about Native American creation myth. They're all kind of a little bit similar. They believe that we came from within the earth and journeyed outwards, and we came to the surface. A lot of them do believe that.
Kind of like the Jules Verne journey to the center of the earth, hollow earth thing.
Exactly, yeah.
Very cool.
And, you know, whereas most of us our reference in terms of, let's say, our spiritual history is the Bible and the flood of Noah, where you had a world before Noah, and then it gets destroyed, and it's kind of like we're in the second world, if you want to call it that. Well, to the Native Americans, they usually have anywhere from 3 to 4 to 5 previous worlds that were destroyed, that they survived the destruction. And so they're in a perpetual cycle of destruction and rebirth, which is kind of interesting. And one of their legends, again, you know, it's kind of like they'll travel from world to world. It's very similar to the Noah story. People get wicked and only a few are chosen to survive and go on to the next world. So the Navajo have a legend. And their very first world was inhabited by this primordial water serpent or water monster, kind of like Leviathan, and it was very fierce. So sometimes on their journeys to the new worlds, they would take with them a relic or an item from the past world. And in one case, they took a monster egg, and it was the egg that belonged to this monstrous kind of Leviathan-type creature. And they don't really say how, but somehow this Leviathan monster of the first world could travel through time or dimensions. It's, you know, it's really hard when you're discussing Native American folklore from hundreds of years ago, you know, maybe they had different slang and ideas, but it seems to imply time travel or dimensional travel where the people make it to the next world with their monster egg, and the mama monster knows about it, so it travels into the second world, and so then they have to go into the third world. And I think this keeps going on until in the fourth world, the baby monster egg hatches, the baby monster comes out, and then baby monster grows to become a regular monster, and so they have to navigate finally into the fifth world. So I just thought that was cool. And I mean, it's interesting by itself, but where my imagination got fired was when I started reading Mayer talk about the very early paleontologists of the Wild West, because that's kind of when paleontology became a thing and they started to find these dinosaur bones and didn't really know entirely what they were. And the early fossil hunters were really interesting. The famous one was probably the Cope Marsh Bone Wars. There were these, do you know who that is, William?
Oh,
it's because you're going to sneeze. Okay.
Yeah, let's rewind.
That's going to be hard to take out.
I don't know. I think we should just leave this in. I think we should roll with it. I think.
Okay, so
there's a marsh monster that causes allergic reactions. All right, I'm there.
Okay, so mythology.
Okay, so we're still on the monster,
and then we'll add sneezing to this.
Yeah, we could. They have a lot of funny Native American folk tales about sneezing, if I remember right. But I was talking about the Cope Marsh Bone Wars. And when William raised his hands, I thought he was going to say, oh, I know all about Cope and Marsh, and then I wouldn't have to explain it, but shoot.
Well, there's where the moisture in the marsh comes
from. Yeah, well, I suppose. Yeah.
The monster that just snots everywhere.
I'm with you 100.
So, Cope and Marsh, I can't remember Marsh's first name, but the Edward Drinker Cope is the one that I kind of like. He's a funny character, but basically he and Marsh were competing paleontologists. They hated each other. They wanted to be the first to unearth this or that discovery, and they hated each other so much, sometimes they would sabotage each other's finds or they would blow up their own dig sites. In fact, Jim Henson, before he died back in the 1980s, he and his daughter wanted to make a biopic movie on just paleontology and Cope and Marsh. And so, I mean, there's definitely a lot of potential for a story with those two. I don't know if we'll use them in this story. I'm just kind of using them as an interesting reference. Maybe we'll come back to them. So the early day paleontologist I'm really interested in was this guy named Charles Sternberg. And he would get so hypnotized by his fossils when he stared at them that sometimes he felt like he would travel through time, like he would just go into a daze, and he would imagine himself back in the prehistoric times so vividly he felt like maybe he had actually traveled there in his dreams or by staring at these fossils. And that was something else that Mara wrote about in her book. And she talked about how some of the Native American medicine men have this idea of tears in the layers of time, kind of similar to the monster that would burrow through time to follow the Navajos into the next worlds.
So, tears, like the veil is torn between.
Oh. Yeah, like a rip or a tear or a, you know, a wormhole, if you want to use space age terminology. But yeah, Mara used the term geochronology. She used the term breaches of geochronology. And medicine holes, kind of like, you know, Native Americans have their medicine. So a medicine hole, like a wormhole. Just to be clear, so it doesn't sound like I'm putting words in Mara's mouth, she doesn't believe any monsters traveled through time. I don't want to make her sound like a crackpot. She's just, you know, relating this old mythology of the monsters that could travel time and how this Charles Sternberg would have these very vivid visions and dreams. And so I feel like we can probably make a story just out of those two ideas of the monster that travels through worlds and time and the paleontologists. And what do y'all think? Where do your imaginations go?
So at this point, we are ending the fact part of the show and entering into the forging of fiction. Beverly, you've got some. There we go.
Yeah, right. So I'm liking the idea of multiple worlds. I'm liking the idea of a birth from within. Doesn't have to be the earth, but a birth from within, and how, and that method of birthing, you know, I'm a woman, I can get into that. And then I also really like the where the membrane goes thin between the two worlds. So that so those things are metaphysically challenging to me, right? And that's fun. The other thing I really like is the idea of two paleontologists kind of scrabbling at each other and scratching each other's eyes out, because that's just so much great conflict. So what if there's monsters that are breaching, to use your word, and I love that word, breaching the time membrane, and they're at each other's throats for their sovereignty of the next world.
Ooh, so. I like it. Yeah, that works.
I'm just going to pause and push the rewind button on some episodes here. We have a theme, it seems like. Beverly, when you were here last, we did the frost giant bone.
Oh,
and now we're talking about bones again.
Yeah, that's true.
And the last several episodes, we've hit on time travel.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's interesting how the show takes on a character of its own, even across multiple episodes.
Well, I want to rewind back to the fact portion, because I forgot to mention the Navajo they won't have anything to do with dead bones. And they were doing some work to dig a dam back in 1930. They were digging a dam and they came across dinosaur bones, and they didn't want to disturb them because they feel like the ghosts are kind of like anchored to the bones, and they felt like they were going to stir up the ghosts of these monsters. And that's the other thing too about Edward Drinker Cope. I forgot to mention, this was also true of the Sioux tribe, where he was digging over around North and South Dakota. And it's also going to go into what Beverly talked about clashing monsters. So two missionaries told this Edward Drinker Cope that The Sioux was well aware of the dinosaur bones and that these bones, quote, belonged to evil monsters which were slain by lightning. And the Sioux also refused to touch the bones for fear that a like fate would befall them. And so what I forgot to mention, or maybe I just felt like it was too much content for us, the Native Americans believed that the thunderbirds of the sky were at war with the water serpents of the lakes and the rivers. So there's your warring monsters, Beverly.
Ooh, okay.
All right.
1950s, and it's not monster on the loose. Mm-hmm. It's paleontologists on the loose. Okay. Oh. And you've got these two competing paleontologists, right? One is trying to get the spirits of all of the thunderbirds together and revive, you know, their ancient mythology of their utopian heaven or world or whatever, if the thunderbirds were to win. And at the same time, you got this other paleontologist who's going after these water serpents and doing the exact same thing. So conflict.
So there's that conflict. Yeah. And are they from different worlds? Are the Thunderbirds, or, I mean, we'll have to create, I say we have to create new monsters. Maybe we don't. Are the flying creatures from different worlds than the...
I'm not so sure. Different worlds? I'm thinking different times. Let's pull Darwin into this, okay? You've got this evolutionary chain, right? And serpents come before winged creatures in the whole theory of evolution. True. So what you could have is like this younger generation having a conflict with the generations that came before it. And so now what you've got is one of the sides have figured out how to breach the time membranes.
They're the Gen Zs.
Okay, why not? Right? So you've got the potential to, you've already hit on it, right? You've got the potential for a social commentary on generational conflict.
Yeah.
Right? And then you've got the time travel thing. You've got this warring paleontologist situation.
Yeah.
Okay. And maybe these paleontologists are from different time periods. Okay. Ooh. So the one paleontologist is from the future, the other paleontologist in the past, and we're stuck in the middle where all the conflict is happening.
So we need personalities for the paleontologists and at least one monster from both realms.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking at least one of them, kind of the squinty-eyed old man, bad luck turns into goofy.
Oh, and he walks with a shillelagh.
Ooh, yeah, it has to. That's a must.
Yeah. All bent over, stooped, very rugged.
Uber intelligent.
In fact, the shillelagh just keeps up his head mostly.
I'm liking it.
So then the younger guy, maybe the younger one is a girl and he's kind of in the face of the old guy. She's kind of in the face, sorry. And maybe not. I don't know. I'm not sure about a female paleontologist.
Well, here's my spin on that.
I actually like that.
But
let's switch them and let's have the paleontologist that's female be an older.
Be the older one. Right? Ooh, like
very well studied, great universities of, you know, whatever. And she's the one who develops the time machine or figures out how to crack the breaching of time to bring all of this together.
It wouldn't be a time machine because it's all spiritual, metaphysical. It's the bones are magical. That's so gotta be, yeah.
So she's actually kind of the quintessential soothsayer sort of in touch with the other world.
Maybe. What if she's one of the Native American tribes elderly the chieftains?
Like a medicine woman?
Yeah, like
and
a medicine.
She's in disguise.
Yeah. And she is perpetually old. She's like Mother Earth incarnated.
Yeah, she doesn't be, change. Yeah.
She could be Spider-Woman. Spider-Woman, I mean, that sounds like a comic book, but Spider-Woman was in a lot of, it would either be Spider-Woman or White Painted Woman, but that can also be touchy. That can be like if you use Muhammad or
yeah, but maybe we don't.
I don't know.
Yeah, maybe we want to create an entirely, kind of a blending. So there's a character in Japanese folklore, too, mm-hmm. that is the old woman that you know, and she walks with a staff, and she's multifaceted, right? She can she can, but it's all in one. You know, there's a side of her that's mean and intolerant and just kind of
motherly,
nasty mother. And then there's the other side of her that's not so much motherly. It's very young and charming. So, but they marry this and. So we could do something like that. So there
maybe
would be,
oh, well, now I'm thinking it is that figure from Japan, but she came to America to resurrect the Native American monsters
because she has a kinship with them.
Yeah,
I like this. I like this. Yeah, yeah. And there's something that she there's some talisman. What talisman does she have that helps her cross worlds or?
I think it'd just be a bone because the Navajos, I mean, almost acted like, I'll take that back. The Navajos and some of the other Native Americans believe that ants could travel through time. It's actually, very funnily enough, it's very much like Ant-Man Quantumania. They believe that ants could transcend different dimensions because ants, somehow the Native Americans knew that ants lived in the days of the dinosaurs. They knew that. And they would see the ants bring up fossils from the earth, little tiny ones, obviously. So, yeah, so maybe it's something associated with an ant because ants could travel through time to the Native Americans, kind of.
Very cool. All right, so earlier in the episode, you mentioned like a mastodon bone. Okay, so what if you have a gigantic portal and its physical form looks like a large mastodon bone, okay?
Uh-huh.
And if you walk in one side, you teleport yourself through time to the other in some fashion, okay? And then you go in one way, and it goes forward in time. You come in the other way, it goes backwards in time. So now it's not really a machine. It's all metaphysical, okay? And we have these competing paleontologists, and we have this wandering medicine woman who's part of the older generation. So the younger version, what if there's an accident somewhere, like a solar flare or some form of planetary alignment that would disrupt the metaphysical, all right? And our wandering sage, our medicine woman, this wise individual who's the incarnation of worldly balance, if you will, of emotion and, good and evil, all of that. She's going through the portal at the very moment that the planets align just right, and then her personality split.
Ooh, cool. I like it.
And now it's a, you got this, you know.
She's unbalanced.
And she's trying to get, you know, back into her, right? So the two halves are now in complete disarray and chaos because they're not balanced with one another. And the paleontologists, right, get their hands on this old sacred text or something prophetic or whatever that describes what's going to happen. Okay, so this is maybe the early part of the story is the MacGuffin, right? Yeah. And they are cohesively not realizing what the other is doing, trying to solve the problem, going about it in a you know, it's they have both the same goal in mind. They have different journeys, and they think that the other is really trying to hinder them. When in reality, they're not. So now you've got the possibility of actually the we need to learn to work together story.
Okay, that's what I was thinking. So let's wipe off our messy drawing board and reiterate for our listeners. The female figure is now, she's not one of the paleontologists anymore. She's her own mystical being at the center of it. And as William said, now we've got the two competing paleontologists that we kind of sort of based on the relationship of Cope and Marsh. It's not them, but it's just based on that. Because that's really cool to have those two competitors. They've got to work together to conjoin this mythical female figure from the past worlds to where she's balanced again. Now we just need to figure out now how do our dinosaur bones figure into this? Because now we've gotten off onto her and kind of, and we can leave the dinosaur bones. We can like sweep them under the rug. But I'm just saying, if we want to keep the dinosaur bones, we got to figure out now how are they figuring into this?
We need bones of some kind because we've got paleontologists, right? So,
Well, okay, how about this? She came to, there was the bones of actually, they just think it's a dinosaur, but the bones in this case actually are of one of the Native American monsters of legend, and they are at risk of actually reassembling it. the sacred woman came through time or whatever to stop it. But now they've got the problem that she split into her two distinct personalities.
And that was the inciting incident, right? Mm-hmm. They got two bones together.
Right.
And it started a clash of metaphysics and it split her up. Mm-hmm. And then they're clashing because they brought up all this bad energy, so to speak.
But if they can get her back together, that slays the monster.
That slays them. So it's a quest.
It's a quest, yeah.
I like quests.
Okay, and then we also have to ensure that we bring in the walking through the sneezing marsh.
Yes, absolutely. I think the sneezing marsh is great. So
it's a field of poppy seeds or something. Or elm trees or pecan trees or something that's just constantly in bloom.
So we've got the Leviathan, or the two monsters are air and water, right?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we've got a marsh where they actually come together.
Mm, yeah.
And at that confluence is really toxic to the human form. And so that's where the sneezing comes in. But it's not toxic to the supernatural form, or whatever we're going to call it, preternatural. I don't know. What are we going to call it?
The comedic relief.
I guess. Yeah. I mean, that could be like a little, what would you call it? Just a little tiny
Tom
flourish.
Tom Bombadil in the middle of the story.
It's just a very small flourish on the story that maybe sneezing signifies the breach in the spirit world and the chindi and the ghosts are flying about and that's why they sneeze.
Something. Or it's just one of the elements you add to save the antagonist or protagonist as a character trait that you're constantly sneezing.
Yeah, that too.
Right. So it adds just that depth to character, and if you really want to push the comedic effect, you just always have them sneeze at the most inopportune time.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and it's not just a little, it's a monster sneeze that silences everybody and sends this kind of shockwave, this literal wave through the room so that everything's arrested for just the tiniest of moments.
Yeah.
And in the end, maybe towards the end, anyway, that suspension allows for the character to draw together because there's a suspension in aggravation, in conflict, just long enough to marry her back to her good form.
And I'm feeling like instead of trying to wrap this thing up in 5 minutes, I feel like this could be a two-parter.
Let's take it.
I feel like this could be our first two-parter because I have a lot of other ideas I want to throw out there too.
We'll take this one into part two. All right. So that, without further ado, I think we'll just hit the outro on this one and you can tune in on Thursday for the next episode of part two with Beverly Coutts. Beverly, give us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm kind of rebuilding my website. It's at Greasewood. So bacoutts.com. Look for more about this lovely podcast. Look for some things going around town. Look for anything bookish, live, and local at bacoutts.com. Currently, my projects are a little bit wide and far afield, but I am working on a fiction workshop for a short story to be held in the fall of this year.
Very cool. All right, folks, without further ado, we have a two-parter coming up on Thursday. You can tune in for that if you want to hear the conclusion that John over there has got percolating in his very creative mind. You can follow us on pretty much any one of your podcast services that you absolutely love, from Spotify, Apple, Google, all the way out to Good Pods. And follow us on Twitter at Plot Pit. We are going to be kicking off the Twitch stream very soon. I've got the studio rebuilt for audio quality. Now it's time to actually hit the cameras. And then we have a couple of readings coming up, done by yours truly, The Raven, for one. If you haven't already caught that, it will be out on the channel. We have some YouTube content also coming very soon. The channel is out. I'm starting to push old podcast episodes, and then there will be some original content that you won't catch on this podcast. John, I think that's about it.
Yeah, I think we got it.
All right, excellent. If you are a reader and want to be on the show, we would absolutely love to hear from you. I'm working to see if I can get a sprint of about 5 to 10 episodes of readers and what you actually enjoy from an author. Follow us on Discord. And I think that's it. So, if you want to be on the show, send us an email at submissions@plotpit.com, and we'll catch you in part 2.